A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 6, 1985, entitled, Follow the Star, Trust the Vision. The text for the sermon is Matthew 2, verse 9. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, this is the season of Epiphany. Its sign is a star, its color is green, which stands for growth, because in this season of the year we celebrate the growth of the gospel which came to the house of Israel, but was intended for all nations. I don't really need those to see you. The season of Epiphany celebrates the universality of the gospel. And the coming of the Magi, the story which we read in the Gospel of Matthew, is a story Matthew tells us as a sign of the fact that now the nations would come to the light of the knowledge of God, that now all peoples would come to enjoy the salvation that he had prepared before his people Israel. Epiphany is a Greek word, or it comes from a Greek word, and it means manifestation. So the season of Epiphany is the celebration of the manifestation of Christ, who is the light of the world. The starlight celebrates, symbolizing the light of Christ that shines in our darkness. Epiphany, then, is a season of great joy, for it celebrates the goodness of God in that he gave to us the revelation of himself. And the story of his grace is told in the nativity of Jesus Christ. Matthew was a Greek-speaking Jew living in a mixed community of Gentile Jewish background people, probably around 80 AD. And the community which had first been Jewish Christian was becoming increasingly Gentile Christian. And in that mixed community, Matthew wrote his gospel to instruct the community and really to say in this nativity story, the delightful story of the coming of the Magi, that what was happening in the growth of the church among the Gentile nations was that which had long ago been prophesied when God said to Abraham, I will make you a blessing, and in you all nations of the earth will be blessed. And that which had been spoken by the prophets as they had the vision of the exaltation of Mount Zion, with all nations flowing to it to be instructed in the truth of God. There was always that universality in the Old Testament as a minor strain. There was always the understanding that God had chosen the one to reach the many, that the election of one people was not to the exclusion of other people, but for the embracing of other people through the ministry of the one people, who would be the carriers of the truth and the knowledge of God. Matthew tells us the story of the coming of the Magi in order to say that which was always latent in the Old Testament was now coming into full bloom. Now all peoples would be drawn to God through Jesus Christ. That's what we celebrate today, January 6th, the Festival of Epiphany, the Feast of the Manifestation of Jesus, the Light of the World. We have just celebrated the 12 days of Christmas. Christmas tide is behind us, and the first implication of the Incarnation is this story, the good news, that there is salvation for all who will come to God through Jesus. God has revealed himself, and Jesus is the Savior of the whole world. And so, to make that point, Matthew tells the story of the visit of the Magi. We speak of three kings. And in speaking of the three kings from Orient, we have embroidered the gospel. Over the centuries, the story has been embroidered with legendary features. And it's impossible at this point to peel all of those off and to get back to the hard core. because the Bible isn't interested in hardcore facts. The historical core behind it was the experience of those beyond the pale of Israel and the light of Revelation who came seeking God and finding Him in Jesus Christ. The story conveys that message. But it's a fascinating story. And the Bible doesn't call them kings, and it doesn't say anything about three. We've done all of that. In fact, if you want to go to Cologne with me this summer, this fall, I'll take you to that magnificent cathedral, and there behind the main altar is the shrine of the three magi. There in a magnificent gold shrine are the remains of the three magi. Well, of course, we make no bones about it. That's just pure myth. But nonetheless, in 1164, Frederick Barbarossa conquered Milan, took the relics, the remains of the Magi, and brought them to Cologne, and they are still there. Whether they're there or not, the gold is really magnificent, and it's quite a sight. But anyway, Matthew tells us about these visitors from the East, and we know that there were people like this. Maybe they were from Parthia or Persia, maybe they were from Arabia, maybe they were from Babylonia. We do know that there were ancient scholars who studied ancient writings and who studied the stars. And we know that through observation, there were those who had come to a great knowledge of the movement of the heavenly bodies, quite amazing knowledge, as a matter of fact. And so that it is not at all surprising that there would have been those who had been studying ancient writings and studying the stars, because it was a rather common conviction that great events were foretold in the movement of stars, and that the birth and the death of great people was signified by the shining of a star or the appearance of a star. And so the fact that there were those in the ancient East who were studying such things, we know from other sources as well. And the fact that they might have come and had sought a world ruler born in Israel, in Palestine, is very, very easy to assume. And as to the heavenly event itself, the star, once again, we don't know. It might have been a supernova, a new star, or it might have been a comet. The most fascinating speculation is that it was the conjunction of the planets Jupiter and Saturn. You can see the show at Muskegon, I understand, and I know you can in Grand Rapids and in Chicago. At Christmas time, they often in planetariums will show you the set of the sky at that time. And we do know that there was an interesting conjunction of planets in 76 B.C., which is about the time that Jesus was born. Saturn and Jupiter, in their rotation, Saturn takes, I think, 12 years and Jupiter 30 years. But every 20 years, they pass each other. And as they pass each other, from the perspective of Earth, it appears that they are together, a conjunction. And then there is an even rarer occurrence when Mars sort of hangs suspended over them as well. And Kepler, the great astronomer, observed this in 1604 in the month of October. And he went on to calculate that it had happened also in 805 and in 7 or 6 B.C., which is just rather interesting, that there was some kind of an astral phenomena that might have been most unusual and might have signified to those that were observing that something was happening, because we know that in the time of Jesus' birth, there was a kind of worldwide sense that there was a hinge of history being experienced and that there would be some dramatic intervention. And so whatever the historical core, that is not really important. The story itself is delightful, and it has made the setting up of a creche an exciting thing for children. And yet behind the story was the purpose of Matthew And the purpose of Matthew was to say, there were those who lived beyond the pale of God's revelation, who yet had a hunger for God, and who sought Him, and who followed the star and trusted the vision until they were led to kneel before Him in worship and adoration. And Matthew was saying, in that mixed community of Jew and Gentile background, what is happening now is the realization of the promise of God of long centuries ago, which has been at work through all the generations of our people. And now, those who have had that hunger from afar are being drawn near to find the light of revelation of the glory of God in the face of Jesus. And so, for Matthew and the telling of the story of Jesus, the Magi at the very beginning were the sign of the nations that would come to Jesus, the nations that include you and me. For it is for us, born beyond the pale of the house of the Hebrews, that Epiphany is especially good news, because it means now that the light of the gospel was to break to all people, and we are the inheritors of that revelation of God. Well, reflect with me on the story for just a moment. I want to say to you, first of all, that God has revealed Himself, and then that those who seek God will surely find Him, and then those that find God will surely worship Him. God has revealed Himself. That is our bedrock conviction. We do not claim that our faith is the consequence of some religious genius or some special insight of some human person or some founder. We do not say that it is the consequence of the best rationality of which we are capable. The Christian faith begins and ends with the claim that it is response to God. Response to God who has encountered us, who has revealed Himself to us. We have just heard all of those marvelous statements again in the celebration of Christmas. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory of the only begotten Son of God. And the writer of the Hebrews, who said our fathers were spoken to by the prophets, but in these last days God has spoken to us by a Son, who is the effulgence of His glory, and who is the very stamp of His being. Or Paul, who said that in Him the fullness of the Godhead dwelt bodily. Or in another place, we have seen the light of revelation, the revelation of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. God has revealed Himself. God has revealed Himself. We almost take it for granted. You all know that. Everybody knows that, don't they? No, not everyone knows that. God has revealed Himself. He has made Himself known. He has made Himself accessible. He is available. He has taken the veil away. And while He continues to dwell in mystery, nonetheless, He has reached out to us in the very flesh of our brother Jesus. Jesus has come to us. He has come to us, drawn near to us. He will laugh with us and weep with us, and He will walk the lonely roads with us. Emmanuel, God with us. God has revealed Himself. And those who seek Him will surely find Him. That was already a promise of the Old Testament prophet who said, if we search for Him with all our hearts, we will surely find Him. And the coming of the Magi for Matthew was the statement that there was a hunger in the human heart for God. The Magi are simply signs of that universal human hunger for God. that hunger that you know, that hunger that reaches out, that's always restlessly pushing you beyond every horizon, making every milestone but a stepping stone. Some have called it the hunger for transcendence. That longing, that yearning, that intuition within us that we were made for something more, that there must be someone who writes in stardust and causes the planets to do his bidding. And the good news of the story this morning is that those who seek him will surely find him. Sometimes in our darkness we almost despair. Sometimes the troubles overwhelm us and circumstance seem to overpower us. It seems as though the heavens are brass and the night is dark and cold. But the message of the gospel, the visit of the Magi, Matthew's good word to you this morning is that if you seek him with all your heart, you will surely find him. To find him is finally to be at peace, for he has created us for himself, and our souls are restless until they find their rest in him. We get so caught up in the mundane, and all of our energies are drained off in the complexity of the network of our lives, human relationships and work relationships and family responsibilities and all of the concerns and the carking cares that eat away like an acid at our soul. But the beating of our hearts tells us there must be something more. There must be one at the heart of things who writes with stardust. And the gospel lesson this morning says, yes, indeed there is. And if with all your heart you truly seek him, you will surely find him. And when you find him, then you will truly worship him. For worship is the irrepressible response of the one who comes into the presence of the living God, having discovered his glory in the face of Jesus. Worship. To worship is to become truly human, to lose ourselves in wonder, love, and praise is to find ourselves. For again, otherwise, it's that dog-eat-dog treadmill existence of a one-dimensional person where there is no transcendence, there is no worship. And where there is no worship, there is no wonder, there is no awe. Then one is dead while one is alive. God has revealed himself. And consequently, I can say to you that if you truly seek him, you will surely find him. And I can promise you that when you find him, you will truly worship him and offer him your life and your substance. For to come to see the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus is to lose oneself in worship. Then the thirst of the soul and the hunger of the heart and the longing of our being is finally fulfilled in the presence of the eternal God who has become sharp focused for us in the flesh of Jesus Christ. And so at the threshold of 1985, as we see another year stretch before us, having just celebrated another Christmas, what has it done for us? He has revealed himself. Have we seen his glory? Have we seen his glory and offered ourselves in new commitment and dedication to him whom to know is life eternal. He has revealed himself, but it is possible in the face of his revelation to miss it. Herod missed it. Herod missed it. They came to Jerusalem because they thought surely if a king were born, a world ruler, he would be born in the palace, in the pomp and circumstance of Herod. But instead of Herod having his faith quickened and his hope heightened, he was rather set upon with fear and terror, because for Herod, the good news was news of impending loss of power. For Herod, if the Messiah were born, his position was in jeopardy. And the human story is really that we never really heed the revelation, but we continue to live by power, lusting for position, concerned about prestige, wanting always to be number one. Herod missed him. Wasn't Herod silly? Wasn't Herod foolish to think that if indeed God's Messiah had been born, that he, Herod, could somehow or other block it, put an obstacle in the way, undercut the plan of God? Wasn't it foolish of him? For if God's Messiah was born, then what could one like Herod do? Foolish Herod. And yet we are foolish too. George Shultz leads the American delegation to Geneva these days to engage the Russian delegation in disarmament talks. And what will happen? Are we going there with goodwill and good intention? We must pray that it will be so. And we must pray that there be some breakthrough, as Gordon led us this morning. And yet, in the back of our minds, we know that there will be posturing and maneuvering, and we know that we will make no compromise that will put us at a disadvantage. And if we will make no compromise that will put us at a disadvantage, then surely Russia will not either, for all that they have suffered, the tragedy they have known in their recent history. Do we not know that our desire to be strong in order to maintain peace creates fear and paranoia in their hearts, which creates the lust for more power? Can we not, who are reasonable people, see what happens in the escalation of this dangerous game? Do we not understand that when we say that we will build our arsenals in order to make ourselves secure, that we have succeeded in creating the greatest insecurity that the world has ever known? Are we really any wiser than Herod, who thought that he could disrupt the locomotive of God's messianic movement? Are we any wiser than he, thinking somehow or other, when we have seen Christmas again, when we have learned that the last reality is love, that the only truth is grace, do we think that we can secure ourselves by power? The scribes and the chief priests missed him too. Oh, they could say, yes, yes, Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. And they could quote the text from Micah's prophecy. But did they take their robes off and make their way 5 miles south to Bethlehem to investigate that they too might worship? No, and I suppose this is especially our peril. We who are so familiar with it all, who know the story, who know the same old story year after year. We know it. What could possibly break through to us that would be new and novel? What could possibly we hear that might change and transform us after all of these seasons, after all of these Christmases? We too have heard it so often. that its strangeness has worn off and its miracle wonder has lost its power to move us. Like the chief priests and the scribes dwelling in the precincts of the temple in the face of a miracle, reading the text and feeling nothing. God has revealed Himself, and those who seek Him will surely find Him, and those who find Him will truly worship Him. Will we be a people of hope in 1985? Will we be fools for Christ? Will we be an alternative community to the community of the world that is posited on power? Will we be ridiculous and live by faith and hope and love? Will we seek the God who writes with stardust? Will we follow the star and trust the vision? Will we be a people who are determined and limited not by what always has been or by some human possibility? Will we be a people who will live by that which has not yet been, but comes to us out of the future, assuring us of what one day surely will be? Will we be a people who will dare to move forward in faith, in hope, in love, looking for the day when every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God? Will we be a people in our own lives who will truly seek Him and truly worship Him and know that another Christmas has been celebrated and we have been changed? Follow the star. Trust the vision. You are a people of hope.